Powers. He's an educator who focuses on the cultural and linguistic effects of technology. He's the author of many books, including The Cultural Dimensions of Educational Computing, Understanding the Non-Neutrality of Technology, and Let Them Eat Data, How Computers Affect Education and the Prospects of Ecological Sustainability, and The False Promises of the Digital Revolution. Jeff Powers is going to speak to us on techno-language versus nature.
Primary conveyors of this idea that the higher knowledge is print-based knowledge. So let's look at what goes on in print, recognizing that there are many advantages to print. And so I'm going to talk about the downside, which is largely unrecognized. The question is, does print provide an adequate representation of what it purports to be about? Let's take an example. Suppose a person is standing on the shore watching the crashing waves. This is an emergent relational ecology that has a long history of influences. But the question is, what happens when that experience is put into print? What do you get in print? Well, what you get is a fixed representation that becomes immediately dated. That is, it doesn't take into account the ongoing relational emergent characteristics of the experience. Now, the point is that what is put into print also is affected by the belief system of the writer. So print gives us this notion of objectivity, of data, of information. It's based on a conduit view of language, a sender-receiver view of language that universities reinforce. But it is only a partial and fixed account of the ongoing relational nature of a lived ecology. The same problem holds for data. And data is becoming the major currency of the educated person, supposedly of the educated person. So what does data represent? Data represents only a fragment of an experience, whether it's in the workplace, whether it's the learning that takes place in the classroom, whether it represents the behavior of the person or thought processes, which are now captured so easily in terms of digital technologies. The problem is that data also is fixed. And it immediately becomes data, but there's an even deeper problem, and that is you cannot digitize what you take for granted. And most of our cultural experience is taken for granted. So most of our experiences are outside the purview of this new form of knowledge that's supposed to be the source of empowerment. What we are getting, in effect, from the digital revolution is a world of abstractions, a world that does not represent the dynamic, relational, emerging nature of our experience. And part of this problem is not just attributed to the digital revolution. It also has something to do with the predominance of our use of nouns. Nouns do not communicate relationships. They communicate a fixed view of reality, and they lend themselves easily to being viewed as objective accounts, as universals, as a truth that is basic to how to understand life. There's another problem with the digital revolution that's not going to be addressed as the educational process is increasingly carried on through the use of computers. And that is that languages, words that is, have a history. They're part of a complex ecology. They can be understood as metaphors. Aside from prepositions and conjunctions, most of our words are metaphors. What does this mean? It means that they carry forward the analogies that were selected, that were identified and have been settled upon over generations, that carry forward the misconceptions, the wisdom, the biases, and the silences of earlier thinkers. What is the importance of this? When we're born into a language community, we learn those words, we learn that vocabulary, but we are also learning these earlier patterns of thinking, which were not formed by an understanding of environmental limits or other cultural ways of knowing. An example of this problem can be seen in the history of Western philosophers. How many Western philosophers, I'm talking about the major ones, Plato on down, How many understood that they were ethnocentric thinkers? How many understood the limitations of abstract thought? How many of them were aware of the cultural commons of their era, which was essential to sustaining everyday life? We have accepted their legacy of abstract theory, and that legacy is now coming back to haunt us in the form of the notion of property, of free markets, of theory that is disconnected from the everyday world, from the world of PrEP. PrEP is inherently ethnocentric, that it profoundly differs from oral traditions. One of the characteristics of metaphorical thinking is that powerful evocative experiences, powerful mythopoetic narratives have become the basis of what are called root metaphors. These are powerful interpretive frameworks with vocabularies that organize our thought process. These vocabularies also exclude other words and concepts that would enable us to see a different reality. Let me give you some examples of root metaphors. Patriarchy is one that you can easily recognize. What it encoded in terms of earlier misconceptions, biases, and silences. Also the root metaphor of anthropocentrism, both of these can be traced back to the book of Genesis and perhaps beyond into the oral cultures. More recent root metaphors include mechanism, viewing the world, and this is the way in which Johann Kepler stated it. He said, "My aim is to show that the celestial machine is to be likened not to a divine organism, but to a clockwork." Well, then Thomas Hobbes, an early founder of liberal thought, said, "For what is the heart but a spring and the nerves, but so many strings and the joints, which, but with so many wheels, give motion to the whole body." These are not archaic thoughts. Currently, Richard Dawkins says, "But another general quality that successful genes will have is a tendency to postpone the death of their survival machines, at least until after reproduction." Your body is a survival machine. Even our friend E.O. Wilson can't get away from the root metaphor of mechanism. He says, "The machine the biologists have opened up is a creation of riveting beauty." And in consilience, he refers to the mind as a machine. A machine that is only a problem of re-engineering. Now, what are these other root metaphors that serve as powerful interpretive frameworks that limit our thought because of the vocabulary of supporting root metaphors to a certain set of outcomes and ways of thinking, and to certain exclusions of what I call silences? These include individualism as a root metaphor, progress, economism, evolution, and I think what you're hearing from the speakers here is that ecology is an emerging root metaphor, and it provides an entirely different vocabulary set of ways of understanding relationships that represent the world as dynamic, emerging, relational, and having a history. Now, it's very unlikely that any student at the public school level or at the university level learning by using a computer and the internet is going to understand that words are metaphors and that language is part of an ecology, and that this ecology of language also influences the ecology of identities, who we think we are, how we are forced by the language to see only certain possibilities. For example, what are some of the words excluded from the mechanistic root metaphor? We see this root metaphor shaping how we approach medicine, agriculture, education, every aspect of life where we're quantifying, obtaining data, trying to determine efficiencies, redesigning that clockwork to be more efficient and more under our control. Is there a word in the vocabulary of the root metaphor to express the experience of sacredness? Is there a vocabulary that communicates how to understand what constitutes wisdom? Is there a vocabulary that helps us understand the traditions that are carried forward? See, one of the examples that is increasingly emerging as problematic and came out in last night's talk is that we do not understand what our traditions are. Well, a noun, the word tradition, that comes to us from the thinking of Enlightenment thinkers. Enlightenment thinkers who only saw the negative aspects of the medieval era, but who ignored the cultural commons of those times, represented traditions as a source of backwardness. Thus, we're always oriented towards progress, towards new discoveries, towards experimentation with various very foundations of life. Now, I'd like to make a case, and there was some discussion about the need to talk about, to talk responsibly about conserving. I call myself a biocultural conservative, primarily because one of the ways in which people have carried on life for centuries, in fact, from the beginning when the first humans were wandering the savannas of Africa, are the cultural commons. The forms of knowledge, skills, mentoring, technologies, crafts, creative experiences that were not monetized, were not commodified, but intergenerationally shared. And that these patterns, these cultural commons, exist in every community today, but they are marginalized because they don't fit the paradigm of finding, of collecting data, of measuring, of looking for what supposedly gives us power to create new alternatives. The cultural commons are important, yet they're being lost because the computer, this is where language comes in and affects how people look at things. Computers reinforce the notion that the older generation has only sources of backward understandings, that they're not contemporary. That to be modern and progressive, one must communicate and think in terms of what is possible on the internet. There's a double bind here, and that is that market forces are enclosing more aspects of the cultural commons. The Eric Schmidts of the computer industry have no understanding of the cultural commons, and this is particularly problematic. Because one of the things that's now being recognized is that more and more of our jobs can be computerized, which means there's less and less need for humans. We all need to participate to some degree in a money economy, but that money economy is disappearing in our culture for many people. It never existed to a very serious extent in many cultures of the world. Yet we're enclosing the cultural commons they depend on. And let me emphasize again that the cultural commons of different cultures include the preparation and sharing of food, healing practices, ceremonies, narratives that are the basis of their moral systems, creative art expression, craft knowledge, games, their systems of social justice, their use of language, and for us, our social justice traditions. Now, the double bind is that as we eliminate, as the youth of the world becomes more oriented toward the internet form of consciousness and more alienated from the knowledge of their parents and their community, they will become more dependent upon a money economy that will not be there. A recent report out of Oxford on how many jobs are likely to be computerized, this was done by Frey and Osborne, reported that within the next two decades, possibly 47% of 404 jobs that they examined could disappear through computerization. The question is, what are these people going to do with their lives if they have no work? The Occupy movement came up, it dealt with this issue, but didn't really recognize, because nobody had talked about it, that the cultural commons represented an alternative economy of trade, of barter, of exchange, of labor, of living more lightly, of also living in ways that lead to the discovery of talents, interests, and patterns of mutual support. I'd like to make one more comment about the digital revolution. Many people, and Schmidt himself makes this argument, that access to data means we'll become more democratic. What is there about the democratic process that we're now experiencing in terms of the digital revolution? Did I have a chance to vote on having my privacy thoroughly compromised by various corporations that now can collect the data and sell it as in packaged forms to corporations and to the government? Did I have a vote about the loss of economic security in terms of the money economy that I'm dependent upon? Lost to hackers that can now breach almost any system? Did I have a vote in terms of the distinct possibility, which we're now beginning to move in, to a cyber attacks? I think that the computer revolution is led by ideologues who equate change with progress. And I'll return to the opening theme. They do not have an understanding of the culture into which their technologies are being introduced. And this raises the question of how do we begin to reform the educational process so they begin to learn something about cultural differences. Thank you.